are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Show weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are ya? Procrastinators, you know who you are. Today's the day. Ante up or file for that extension. We'll take on the cultural cacophony in small measure, some great tunes, inspiration to action, charm, success stories, and speaking of which, what's the prime creative age? It may surprise you. We're going to start, though, with a conversation with a fascinating author, a great new book. You know, I've been talking about it. Paula Martinac, the author of The Ada Decades, will join us in just a moment. And I'd love to get you in the mix. Are you listening live? It is Tuesday, April 18th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. That 24/7 Twitter feed you're so enamored with, it's bursting at the seams as per usual. At AB Writes, have at us when it works for you live or on podcast. The TCS team, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, tell us the Facebook page and the PopNet chat box also open for the show. So connect when and where it works for you. The show today brought to you in part by Audiophile, from music to books to podcasts. Caress your ears with everything you want to hear from Audiophile. Also by Geico. Find out how 15 minutes or less can save you 15% or more on your car insurance. Geico.com is the place for that. And by our aforementioned friends at PopNet, it's arts, culture, and conversation on air, online. PopNet features select editions of the Amy Beth Markowitz Show. So delighted to welcome Paula Martinac to the show. She's the author, most recently, of this compelling new, I guess she calls it a short story collection, they're connected stories, called The Ada Decades, and it spans, I guess, about 70 years in the life of Ada Shook, who is a young girl, starts out as a young girl in a small mill town in North Carolina in 1947, and we take her all the way, I think, till 2015 as an older woman. She has a very fascinating life as a school librarian. I know that sounds boring to people, but it really isn't, and we'll talk about why. And she goes through a lot of different changes as the world changes, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, and all of these things with very real, compelling characters. Fascinating indeed. Hey, Paula, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on this great new book.
Oh, thanks, Amy Beth. I'm really happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. Talk to us a little bit about the idea of doing stories versus a novel, and does it matter? I know some folks have compared this to Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kittredge, the Pulitzer Prize-winning short story collection, which I love, and I know you love it too. I think, actually,
yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with Ellen Gilchrist's Rhoda Manning stories, but it kind of reminds
me
of her story.
No, I'm not, but I... Yeah, but I've always loved interconnected stories. Alice Munro's The Beggar Maid, Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, books like that have always been favorites of mine. So it's a great question, and I had always wanted to do something in this format, and I actually was writing what I hoped was going to be another book of interconnected short stories that sort of, they just kind of petered out. They didn't really go anywhere. But one of those stories was the first story in which I met Ada, and it's the story in which she's an older woman in 2015, as you pointed out, she's 80 years old, and an older man with dementia wanders into her front yard. And as I wrote that story, I became more and more interested in Ada and her background and her life in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I knew that she was a school librarian. As I went back in time thinking about her, I realized that she had started her career just as school integration was happening in North Carolina. And so I got really interested in that. And I thought the best way for me to really tell Ada's story would be to do it in what I call a novel in stories. So each chapter is a story, a piece of her life over 7 decades. The stories could stand on their own, but when you put them all together, they form an arc of this one woman's life over the course of these 70 years in which she is growing up and then having a career and then in retirement, living on her own. And it felt like these snapshots of her life were really the best way to cover that full sweep of her life.
And is that like, as opposed to saying, I'm going to set out to write a novel, it was stories, and then they just happened to connect together, or you really had this idea of connecting them from the beginning?
No, I had the idea. After I wrote the first story about her, I thought that would be a great way to do it. I didn't want to leave her character, but I thought it would be kind of an artificial way to write it to have an older woman thinking back or something like that, you know, that would create a traditional novel. And so because I was intrigued with this format, and particularly, as you said, with Olive Kitteridge, where she ages through time also in those stories, I think it's a good way to, if you want to present the full sweep of a character's life, it presents a really good way to do that.
Fascinating, it really is, and it does work, and they do, as you said, I guess they can stand on their own too, but once you're in the book, and you don't want to let go of it, so you do want to read the whole thing, which is great too, as a reader.
Right. And I started...
And it's funny.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I started, as I said, with the one where she's 80 years old, and then sort of plotted it out as to what stories would be the best to tell in each decade, or, you know, there are a few that occur in the same decade, but what were the most important points of her life to show and to illustrate, and so had a sort of roadmap for myself as I went along.
And how she navigated each of those big, sweeping social changes that were happening in the world around her, which is fascinating, too. But it's funny that you were talking about when she came to you, and I think I read somewhere in your back information that when you first encountered her, you thought she was this heterosexual widow and that she somehow set you straight. And I thought that was fascinating because as a writer, I always tell people the characters will, if you let them, they will lead you to where you're supposed to go. How did she come to you? You know, when you really found out who she was and what her life was about. I mean, it came to you obviously in pieces, I'm guessing.
Yes, and as I said, I was writing these stories about an older man with dementia, and I had placed him in North Carolina living with his daughter. And I was thinking about someone, I was thinking about the Silver Alerts because friends of my parents had actually had dementia and had gotten out and could not find his way back home. And so it was something that I had been thinking about. And I was thinking about him and put him in that situation, and I actually, when I started to write the story, thought it was his story. But it became clear to me as I started to write it that it was really her story, and I became much more interested in her. And I knew, it sort of started too because I had seen an older woman in my neighborhood. I live in an older mill community in Charlotte, which is where Ada lives as well. And I'd been walking around and I saw an older woman who was very guarded, which is kind of unusual in my neighborhood. People were usually very friendly and outgoing. And I started thinking about her, and I didn't really, you know, I only saw her a couple of times after that. She is pretty shut up in her house. And I just wondered about her and what would cause someone to do that. And when I was thinking about it, I thought, well, maybe she's a widow and she lives alone and she's, you know, concerned. She doesn't want people to see her as vulnerable. And then as I started writing her that way, then I realized that she was a widow, but that, in fact, she was gay, and that was sort of another layer onto why she would be guarded, because for years she was used to being guarded. She couldn't be out. She worked at a school and certainly couldn't be out there, and her partner was a school teacher. So it added another layer to it for me as I realized that it was not just feeling vulnerable about living alone, but feeling vulnerable as an older lesbian on her own and not really wanting people to know about that.
Right. Fascinating. But I mean, this came to you. I mean, that's the process of how characters come to you, right?
That's right.
You listen, you wait for them to, kind of come,
right,
and they show you the way. Yeah.
That's right.
That's interesting. So we meet Ada in 1947, I believe it opens. She's a young girl. She finds, I don't want to go through the whole story because I don't want to give things away, let people read it, but she finds a disturbing image that her father has. And we see that she's kind of awkward. She's a very introspective, bright girl. She manages to get herself a scholarship, which was unusual at the time for a girl, especially from that community, to go to college.
Right.
Her father's not too thrilled about it. Her mother thinks it's a good idea, and she does, and she branches out, and she gets a job as a school librarian, and some people would say, oh, this is going to be boring. But really, librarians, I mean, pick why did you make her a librarian? Because it's not boring at all. But, you know.
Right.
Conscious decision to make her a librarian, or was it something that came to you as well through her?
That just sort of came to me as well. I didn't, I knew that I wanted her to work at a school. I wanted them both, she and Cam, her partner, to work at a school. So that would be one layer of having to hide in a particular way, because school teachers in particular would be very vulnerable in terms of being gay. Anyone who works with children would be, you know, highly suspect, would be able to be fired at a moment's notice. So I wanted her to be vulnerable in that way, and I thought of making her a librarian because I had this image of her as being a very bookish girl who goes to the library after school and studies, and she has this sort of mentor, a public librarian named Miss Ruthie, who kind of takes her under her wing. And Miss Ruthie's kind of a gruff middle-aged woman, but she does take to certain children who she thinks are very studious and want to learn. And she takes Ada under her wing and really talks to her about books and points out books to her. And I saw that as being something that's very formative for Ada, that she would have this experience as a young girl, depending on the guidance of her local librarian, and being very influenced by the librarian. The librarian is very pro-integration and very pro-civil rights, and so that's very influential to Ada as well. And so it seemed natural to me that she would want to pursue that path of this woman who had made such a big impression on her at a young age.
Yeah, it all feels very real, I will say, when you go through the book and there are so many different things and characters that sometimes it disappoints. You're disappointed by the end of the chapter, I'll say, or the end of the story, or you're saying, oh, I wish it happened a different way. But then you realize it's real, very realistic, very authentic, the feeling that there are characters that will disappoint you without giving too much away. Because people
right.
in real life disappoint you, let's face it, right? But it's interesting that she enters her job right on the cusp of integration. So, of course, there's all that drama that's fraught with what happens when the first black children arrive at the school. And
right.
certainly she has some issues with books that they don't want, some of the parents don't want the kids to read. So there's a lot of drama there. There's a lot of fodder that's interesting. And then, of course, she does meet her significant other, Cam, who is a kind of an opposite kind of character. She's a much more vibrant, lively English
yes.
teacher, more outgoing. And at this point, you know, it's Ada's exploration, too, and her whether she realizes who she is and realizes her sexuality. I guess she's had some stirrings, some questionable
yes.
feelings when she was in college with a roommate, and then Cam kind of brings her out of her shell and introduces her to a colorful cast of characters at a book club meeting and all these kinds of things. One thing leads to another, and they finally, you know, are together. And
right.
But as you said, living this life in the 50s, 60s, I guess we're already 60s by now, of, you know, a time in North Carolina, which, you know, unfortunately, North Carolina is kind of having a resurgence of some of this stuff where you're living now, as you know.
Yes, right, right.
Not for the
yes,
good, that's for sure, right? The bathroom
right,
bill and all
right,
the other,
so that... Yeah, so that people, yeah, I mean, we're looking at history here, and we're looking at, you know, some horrible things that could happen to gay people if they're outed. I talk about that in one chapter in particular with one of the gay men, gay male characters. But, you know, a lot of this stuff is still happening, and we're seeing, as you said, a resurgence of violence against against LGBT people, against LGBT community centers, things like that have had a lot of violence recently. And then, yes, North Carolina absolutely is not a hospitable place right now to be gay. So, or to be trans, to be LGBT in general. So, yeah, these things kind of swing on a pendulum. We go a few steps forward and we take a few steps back again. And so I'm very conscious of this fact that civil rights isn't a straight path. It's not just a clear line. You know, we get equal marriage rights and then, you know, it's clear sailing from then on out. It's not like that at all.
Right. Which is why this book and what you talk about is so important, I think, for a lot of people to sort of anchor it and say, well, this is what it was like, this is how far we've come, and this is how far we might be slipping back again. So you got to kind of watch it. So it brings it
yes, right.
to the forefront,
yeah.
which is an important social underpinning of it. But
right.
on the personal side, there are so many, as you mentioned, you have a lot of these characters, the supporting cast that's very fascinating, too, and things they go through. And a lot of things come up. I mean, it's just, you know, again, without giving everything away, just the idea of civil rights and the idea that gay women, these gay women who are closeted, and people know they're friends, but nobody really knows they're officially out. They share it with very few people, and then some of the reactions that they get from people you think they think would align with them, and they don't. It's kind of crushing, and then, you're, as I said, you're disappointed in those characters, but then you're saying, yeah, but you know what? It feels real. You know, it's true. People, unfortunately, will disappoint you. Even things like ageism and when people are ill, again, with illnesses and people backing away from people who are ill and that kind of thing, you have characters reacting in ways that are unbecoming, but again, it feels like it's a real life, you know, there are real life lessons there, real life stories. So
Right. And yes, and we've all had that people form their own communities, particularly people in a subculture like the LGBT community. They can't be out, and so they form families of choice or whatever. But, you know, very often members of our families of choice will disappoint us as much as our biological families may disappoint us. So I wanted to show that as well, but also to show the love and continuity. I mean, Cam and Ada have a really good gay male friend named Twig who is with them throughout their lives. And I really wanted to show that strength of relationship as well. And there's a scene where Cam is out with Twig and she just looks at him and, you know, loves the fact that they've gotten old together and that they both have white hair and they've sort of made it through together. And I felt a lot of affection for that particular character and for that relationship.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. All of those, you know, I didn't mean to harbor on the negative. I'm just saying that felt real. But you're right, all the good qualities and how you nurture the relationships, the family that you build outside of your own family. And there's certainly disappointments in the families, and there's a class difference between Ada and Cam as well, where Ada comes from a very humble, lower middle class, working class family, and Cam's family appears to be much wealthier. At least her mother is very wealthy, I think, and her father is a professor, and
her mother comes from old money in Savannah, and there is a chapter in which they go, Ada and Cam go to spend Christmas with her parents, and it turns into a pretty traumatic experience for them. And Ada is always, as you say, she's from a very different class. Her father worked in the cotton mill, and her mother did as well for a while, and so she's from a very humble background. She's a scholarship girl. She's kind of struggles with, even though she's gone to college, she struggles to use grammar correctly. For example, she has to stop herself a couple of times because she'll say something incorrectly, and so she's very conscious of her class, particularly as related to Cam, who she says at one point she looks like she just stepped off a horse. So she reminds her of the young women that she knew in Chapel Hill who were very wealthy, and she didn't really fit in.
Yeah, it's a whole issue of fitting in that permeates the whole thing. You go through, you take them to New York during for a gay rights march, right? Or
yes.
Yeah. In the 80s, I think it is. And of course, Ada, it's also interesting the idea of activism, that Ada is very much as on board with the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement as Cam, but she's not as out there. You know, in other words, I think people today are not prone to go to the marches, but they definitely will call the senators and that kind of thing. So that's also realistic because not everybody goes out and marches, you know.
Right,
definitely, I'm going to be there no matter what. You know, she has to be on the scene because it's historic.
Yes.
You know,
someone did ask me if what would Ada and Cam be doing in 2017, and I said that Cam would definitely have gone to the Women's March and worn a pink hat, a pink pussy hat, and Ada would have stayed home and written to her senators, and that's just, you know, there's sort of two sides of the same coin, and Cam is much more out there, but they have the same worldview, essentially, is what I wanted to say, and that's why they can make it work, really, because they have the same value, they have the same sort of moral center. But Cam really pushes Ada to acknowledge that, for example, that segregation is wrong. So she really pushes her to voice her opinion and to take a stand, and so they complement each other in that way.
Yeah, it's very real. It's very, you can see them very, you know, the push and pull of it, and how that relationship would play out. It's very well done and very effective, I think. So congratulations on that. And I think
thank you. Thanks.
Well, you're welcome. I think a lot of people will be moved by it and will see it as, you know, because you get so much in there, as I think fiction can do.
Yeah.
As opposed to other forms of writing journalism. I know you've been involved
I really wanted to portray a long-term relationship. You don't see it too much in fiction in general. You don't see it very often at all in LGBT fiction. It's more about the getting together or the, you know, the initial stages or even breakups. But the over the long term and all the things that can happen in a relationship and how people, you know, one partner may be stronger at times than the other and they switch roles as the stronger person at different times. And I really wanted to show that, how that could happen over the course of 40 or 50 years of two people being together. And particularly being together, it's always sort of fascinating to me that people were together for decades, 40 and 50 years, without the benefit of marriage, without any kind of, you know, having to hide, without having any kind of legal recognition whatsoever. And it's just kind of amazing to me that couples were able to do that. And I really wanted to honor that and to look at it, but not to glamorize it. You know, there's a lot of difficult stuff that couples have to go through that I wanted to depict as well.
Yes, and you do that as well. And when you get towards the end of the book, where things have, again, not giving away everything, but Ada comes to meet a pair of younger lesbians who are, in fact, married, because at this point they're allowed to get married. And her reactions to that, and it's also interesting, because there are some people who, and I don't know if they're all, well, of course, there are heterosexual couples, too, who live together for a long time and don't get married. So some people feel that they just don't want to get married for whatever their reasons may be, or they're just used to the way it is. The idea that, you know, do we have to do it, you know, and that kind of thing.
Right. And it's just so foreign to Ada because the terms that we've used for each other have changed so much over the decades, and she would have said that Cam was her friend, and maybe in her circle of chosen family she might have called her lover, but more often she would have said friend, and then maybe later partner. But you know, to think about using the word wife is just so foreign to her, and you know, for many people. You know, I'm certainly not Ada's age, but for many people of my generation too, that saying the word wife is, you know, I trip over it sometimes myself, because for so many years we had other terms, and so to be able to embrace that is really something for a new generation. I see younger women saying wife all the time, and they don't trip over it at all because it's, you know, something that is just becoming common to them now.
It's always that way. Well, got to watch it, though, with all the things happening where they're trying to, you know, take back those rights, which is very disheartening
in
some of these.
Right.
But talk about this book. As, you know, you mentioned lesbian and gay fiction. As someone who's not in a lesbian and gay community, and not having been familiar with your work before, I look at this book and I'm like, this is a book that will probably bridge into a more mainstream audience, right? I mean, are you expecting that? Are you looking forward to having a more mainstream audience with this book? Because I think it really does cut across any kind of genre.
Yes, I would. I would love that because it's, you know, while the main character is a lesbian, it is a story of... It's a story of a relationship. It's a story of that can be seen as universal because, as I said, there's not a lot in literature in general about long-term relationships. So I think that's an interesting piece of it. But you know, I think too often LGBT stories aren't seen as universal. Obviously, we have our particular aspects of history and our particular issues and challenges that we've faced, but ultimately, the story can be universal, and I would hope people would look at it with that regard, and also that there were so many, when I was reading and doing research, I found that there were so many lesbians and white lesbians and gay men who were part of the civil rights movement, which I had never known. And so it was an interesting piece for me that I wanted to explore how people might have become involved in that. And so race is a constant throughout this book. It was something that was very interesting to me as a white woman living in the South for the first time. Something that really struck me and you know made me think about my own relationship to race, even growing up in the North. So I think there are a lot of universals in this book that people can get out of it. It's not, I didn't write it specifically for lesbians. I wrote it for people who were interested in history and interested in the history of the South and how history could shape one woman's life.
Yeah, I think you've done that. So I think it really will appeal to a lot of people if people get to see it. So I hope a lot of people get to see it who are, in all walks of life, because I think they will be fascinated by it and moved by it. Because as I said, you do it quite well, and you do bring a lot of these social underpinnings to the fore. At the same time, you see these this woman's life and all her, her supporting players, her lover, her friends, and to some extent her family. You see a little bit of her family. You don't get that much about her family,
right,
but you get enough to where they're coming from.
Right.
Some interesting things. Also, end of life issues with her father being ill and issues with her brothers. I mean, things that pop up that everybody has to deal with at one point or another, I think, are just so told in a way that's just very specific to her, which then makes it ever more potent to other people to relate to, I think. So,
right.
So good luck with that. Get
ready. Yes, thank you.
Might have a breakout. I mean, there have been stories. I mean, going back as far as Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour, I mean, there are things that have gay themes or gay characters.
Yes.
That other people, seep into mainstream culture. Of course, there's Brokeback Mountain, a couple of years ago. That was a big sensation.
Right,
more than
right,
a couple,
right.
A decade ago.
Right. And
time flies, right? Really good stuff. And as I said, it really reminds me a lot of Ellen Gilchrist wrote a Manning story. I don't know, you've got to read Ellen Gilchrist if you don't know her. I think she won the National Book Award back in 1983 for Victory Over Japan, which is the first book that were introduced to Rhoda as a child. This is why it reminded me, because you see Rhoda as a child in that book. I think there are a couple of collections that are just about Rhoda. And then in the last book, or most recent book that I think I read of Ellen Gilchrist, I don't know, that's your last book, a couple of years ago, called Acts of God, also a short story collection, Rhoda is, I think, 80. So you see
great.
Starts out in World War II, collecting cans for the government or whatever, and she's a feisty girl, and then she winds up, many years later, having been married and divorced and whatever her exploit.
That's great. I'll have to look for this.
Yeah. Check it up. I think there are a couple of collections that are just on Rhoda Manning. She has a couple other characters that she does the same thing with. She's a fascinating author.
Part of me would actually like to do a little prequel to this, and I'm very interested in the character of Cam, and she has a relationship with an African American woman before she meets Ada. So you may see more of these characters in the future.
What are you doing now? Are you on to another project?
I am. I've just finished the first draft of a new novel that it's quite different. It takes place in 1983 in New York City and a little bit in North Carolina. But it's about a young woman who is an assistant or a companion to an older woman writer who was part of the lost generation of in Paris in the 20s and 30s. So quite different, yeah. But again, it sort of has the same continuity of I like the way the past speaks to the present. James Baldwin said, "History is not the past; we carry our history with us." And I love that. I think that's so true. So I think in a lot of my work, I've been interested in how the past and the present speak to each other.
Right. Well, it's Gertrude Stein, right? Wherever you go, there you are, or something like that.
That's right. Right. Right.
I think that's Gertrude Stein, maybe. But yeah, interesting. And of course, you do North Carolina plays, Bill. You moved to North Carolina for the last several years, right? And so that's why you were so fascinated by this as a setting, I'm guessing.
Yes, we moved in 2014, and I had only I'd been to graduate school in Virginia, but mostly I had lived in New York State, in New York City, and in Pennsylvania. So I think the culture shock was a big one for me, and something that really spoke to my writing, and the landscape itself spoke to me, so that it was something that I wanted to write about.
You've done it well, and I'm guessing, I don't know, what was the verdict from the local North Carolinians?
I'm sorry? My writing group. I have two writing groups. One of people who live in the north, and then the other one of a local group of women that I meet with once a month. And Yes, the women who were native North Carolinians offered me a huge praise by saying that they couldn't tell that I was from the North at all. So that was high praise.
That's high praise.
Coming from native North Carolinians, right?
There you go. You got it. Fascinating okay. book, The Eight of Decades. Paula Martinack is the author. Congratulations. I think people will love it. I've been talking about it for a while now, on and off. And if you want to find out more, you do have a website. It's paulamartinack.com. I will put it up for everybody when we have the podcast as well. And
Thank you.
I assume you're touring with it, or are you doing anything that people you'll have information on your website, I guess, where you're going to be, etc.
Yes, all the events are there. The a handful of readings and other radio shows, and going to be in New York in June. So yeah, different things coming up.
Terrific, Paula. I wish you the best, continued success, and please come back and see us again. Okay.
Thank you so much, Amy Beth. It was great. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Thank you. You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Paula Martinack, details, paulamartinack.com, and reach out to us here at the show. Twitter feed AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505.
Carolina, can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina. She's a silver sun. You best walk her away and watch it shining. Watch her watch the morning come. A silver tear appearing now. I'm crying, ain't I? Gone to Carolina in my mind. There ain't no doubt. Might have heard the highway calling, geese in flight and dogs at bite. Signs it might be omens say I'm going, going, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. With a holy host of others standing around me, still I'm on dark side of the moon, and it seems like it goes on like this forever. You must forgive me if I'm up and gone to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm gone. Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Gone to Carolina in my mind. And I'm gone to Carolina.
Come and go, all the miles on this road. All the times I've passed the sign. Oh, Greensboro. From Maryland, the Quakers came and built a where they could pray in the foothills of great mountains there. Opened up the gate for the mills to ship their freight. And it was here those rebels ran. Oh, Green.
Shows. We give a tip of the hat to Paul Martinack, the author of that compelling new book, Novel and Stories, I guess you call it, The Ada Decades. Check it out. Details at her website, paulmartinack.com. I will post it all for you with the podcast. Don't forget all the Emmy Beth Darkly shows are archived as such. Follow us at the BTR site, Mixcloud, Stitcher, and other places. Twitter feed at AB Writes. Folks chiming in about the conversation. Renata says, great chemistry, great conversation. I will check out the book. Lonnie says, another compelling convo, AB. Thank you. And Dee Dee says, I'm looking at the website now. So there you go, Paula. We're getting you some readers, getting you some new fans. Henry chiming in, good conversation, but you're going to talk Trump, right? You guys with your Trump bait. You're always doing it. We'll get to it. We will. But first, let's sing out. With Cat Stevens. Creativity on the Amy Beth Darkly Show.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. Cause there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. You can do what you want. The opportunity's on, and if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, it's easy. You only need to know. Well, if you want to say yes, say yes. And if you want to say no, but there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. And if you want to be me, be me. And if you want to be you, but there's a million things to do, you know that there are. You can do what you want. The opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, it's easy. You only Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free. Cause there's a million things to be. You know that there are, you know that there are, you know that there are, you know that there are. You know that there are.
Change. When will you write your mind? what's good for you. You're not good for anybody,
time. Coffee.
Beatles on the Amy Beth Arcoe Show. Also, For Louise, a not-so-forgotten classic track from Dire Straits and Lady Rider. James from Billy Joel. Boy, Trudy rooted around the archives for that one from the Turnstiles collection, I believe. And James, when will you ever write your masterpiece? My ultimate creative anthem, Sing Out, the Great Cat Stevens song from the never-released soundtrack to that quirky film called classic Harold and Maude. Indeed. Talking about creativity, you know, I always say you're never too young or too old to plunge into the creative well because it's the ultimate fountain of youth. It'll keep you young, but a lot of people think it's over after a certain age. You just can't be creative anymore. Not true. Check out this article, and I think we posted it on social media last week. Didn't have a chance to discuss it, but it's an intriguing article about Dr. John Goodenow, who is a physicist and inventor. He's 94 now, but back in 1946, he was 23 years old, out of the Army, headed to the University of Chicago, wanted to study physics, got there, and a professor warned him that he was already too old to succeed in the field. Well, he recounted the story laughing to a reporter about it. He ignored the advice, of course. At 94 now, he has just set the tech industry abuzz again for his creativity. He and his team at the University of Texas at Austin have filed a patent application on a new kind of battery that, if it works, promised to would be so cheap, lightweight, and safe that it would revolutionize electric cars, kill off petroleum-fueled vehicles altogether. Now, the announcement caused a stir, not just because of his age, but also because he's done it before. Back in 1980, at the ripe old age of 57, he co-invented a lithium-ion battery that shrank power into a tiny package. It's amazing, right? Because everybody thinks that creativity is over and out by the time you're 25, at least. And that's still going strong, that fallacy. Young people are just smarter was a declaration that Mark Zuckerberg made at Stanford back in 2007 when he was 22 years old, and of course the honcho at Facebook. Well, he's a little older now, he's walked it back a little, because that's what happens. As these people that are so high on youth, when they're youthful, you know, God willing, knock on wood, they get older, right? That's what happens. They have to walk it back. But really, if you think about it, a lot of people create great work much later in life. Writers, painters, inventors, certainly they said the patents of people who are over 55 are the most valuable patents they have. So keep on keeping on, I always say. I may be old, but I'm not over. I mean, I'm old enough now to remember when I was too young, where people said, you want to be a writer? Do you have anything to say? You're too young. You know, so too young, too old. I always say from where you are is where you're supposed to be and keep going. You're never too old. You're never too young. Plunge in, do it. It will keep you young, too, which is very important. So that's the story, as they say. Inspiration Action Challenge, Cass in Waverly, Rhode Island, is working in the artist shed, cleaning it out, clearing it out, and getting ready for sculpture and a mural. Yeah. You got me focused, thoughtful, and walking lighter, so thank you. That sums it up. That kind of sums up the whole Inspiration Action Challenge. Keep on going, Cass. Hey, if the Inspiration Action Challenge has worked for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out. Please reach out to the website. On the other hand, you need a little nudge, we'll give you a creativity coaching counseling conversation. First one is always on me. Give me about 2 to 3 weeks, maybe 2 weeks to connect now because tax time is over, so I'll get there sooner. Amy Beth Arkawy, ARKAWY.com is the place to go, and we'll chat and put a lighter step in your life. Maybe that will help, right? And while you're at the website, you can peruse my stories, Eliza Gordon Mysteries, other goodies, all available for ebook and paperback. You can also chime in with your guest suggestions and Forgotten 45 requests. It's a one-stop shop at the website, amybetharkawy.com. It's also tax day. If you haven't paid up yet, haven't revealed your taxes, if you're Donald Trump, that's for sure. I guess he must have filed them or filed for the extension. But today's the day. You got a couple of extra days, so they're saying they're not going to keep most post offices open. They usually stayed open until midnight. So you better file ASAP or get that extension in, as they say. And by the end of it all, we'll all want a little extra money. That's for sure. It is the end of the third question.
surrounded by the most taxing array of lunatics.
Everybody has to pay taxes, even businessmen.
Can't buy me love. Everybody wants my dough. Can't buy me love. No, 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 no. Buy me a turkey club, my friend, with a side of watercress. I don't have any money to spend. It went to the IRS. I don't think it's fair if I got no money to.
When I was a young boy, talked to my father. He didn't know. I talked to my friends. He didn't know. I talked to my brother. He didn't know. I talked to everybody that I knew. It's money that matters. Lived up on the county line. I was washing his car with a friend of mine. He was a little fat guy in a red jumpsuit. I said that looked kind of funny. He said I know it does too. I got a great big house on the hill. Sidewalk and sidey. Great big pool in my backyard. Another great big pool inside. Sidey is funny and matters. Hear what I say.
Going over last month's bills, and I find that you people have confused me with the Treasury Department.
Oh, don't start that again, Dad.
I don't mind giving the government 60% of what I make, but I can't do it when my family spends 50%.
Well, why should the government get more money than your own family?
That's what I want to know. Why should the government get more than your own flesh and blood?
Well, that's just the way they have of doing things.
You're a rich girl, and you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a bitch, girl, but it's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far. You can get along if you try.
Forgotten 45 from Hall & Oates on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show for Lolly and via Twitter for Kevin. Rich Girl on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, indeed. Some taxing tunes. Pay You Back with Interest from the Hollies for Simp. Also a great one from Randy Newman and Mark Knopfler. It's the Money That Matters. Parody classic via the TCS crew, Can't Buy Me Lunch. So give me that turkey with watercress. Sounds good. I'm getting hungry. And Barrett Strong, I Need Money. That's what we all need these days. Taxing times for sure. I hope you got your returns in, and I hope you're getting a refund. I never get a refund, so I wait till towards the end. It's all done, all said and done, as of yesterday. Both what I owe and the estimated, et cetera, the accountant got paid, all of it. So, yeah, buy me lunch, indeed. On the other hand, Donald Trump, where are your taxes? Will he reveal them? Won't he reveal them? It doesn't look likely. Yesterday at the press conference, the daily briefing with Spicy, in and out of hot water and in and out of the rabbit suit, right? Depending on whether you're watching the real-life parody play out or Melissa McCarthy's version on Saturday Night Live. Anyway, finally somebody asked, is he, you know, he keeps saying he's under audit, and they finally said, well, is he just going to say, come out and say he's just not going to show him? Spicy's response, we'll have to get back to you on that. Mm-hmm. I think that may be coming soon, but it's hurting him in the polls. I know Trump feels that the election is over, he won, get over it, right? That's his tweet the other day was, I don't understand why people are still talking about the tax returns. I did the impossible. I won the Electoral College for a Republican, so it's over. And I think there was one tweet yesterday or the day before that had, he wants to investigate the quote-unquote small crowds that are gathering. In other words, these people who are protesting or being paid to do so. Not true, and they're not so small. But intriguing that he thinks it's over. Stop talking about it. Well, they are still talking about it. And a recent research poll says that 68% of the people want to see the tax returns. His credibility and truthfulness rating has gone down. It's plummeted between 12 and 18 points, depending upon what category you're in, whether you're a conservative, Republican, or Democrat. And it's 42%, which I thought was rather high. So he's over 60% at one point with his believability, since he lies with impunity over and over again. I'm startled. It's that high, actually. But on the Twitter feed right now, let's see a few of these folks saying, Silver says, we have not seen Trump's tax returns yet, but we know they'll show he's heavily involved with Russia. Tax march, tax march, tax march. Well, we'll see. We're not going to know, but it sounds like you're hiding something if you don't want to reveal it, right? It does sound that way, you know. Lingo says, get over it, Trump isn't showing the taxes, and he's prez. Yeah, well, some people say that. Blowback for the Democrats in Georgia. This is the thing that's going on today, the special election. They've got one Democrat running and like 11 Republicans. The problem is, and this guy John Ossoff, who I think originally came from that district but has since moved on. He's been working with the National Security Council, other things. Some call him a carpetbagger. He's got a big lead in the polls, but you have to get to 50% or higher or there will be a runoff for the top two vote-getters in June, and if the other vote-getter is a Republican, he may have a harder time in June, so we'll see if he can pull it off, but he's closing in so far. It looks pretty promising, but we'll see. Tim says, yes, America wants to see your tax returns, Chicken Donald, and they have pictures of him all over the place with the chicken thing, so we'll see how it all plays out. But some people are saying there'll be a backlash against the Democrats if they push too hard. I'm not so sure. These town hall meetings in which the Republicans are feeling the heat are very reminiscent of the Tea Party surges that occurred back in 2010, 2011 when people came out against the Obamacare proposals. And the Republicans did take back the Senate and the House. Remember when the Democrats had both of those, and now we don't. So we can still do it. You got to be vigilant. You got to call your reps. You got to get busy, as they say, and stay busy, indeed. Hey, thanks so much for joining us and playing with in real time. Don't forget, it's an ongoing deal here, as you know, at AB Writes on the Twitter feed. You can follow our producer, Trudy Hart, at Radio Trudy. Friend me on Facebook. And, of course, hop over to the website, amybetharkowy.com. Follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show BTR site, Stitcher, Mixcloud, iTunes, NetNow, and be on the listen. Select editions on ARN and the Pop and PopNet as well. You want to find us? You'll find us. Thanks again to Paula Martinak. Her book, Fabulous Eight of Decades, is out. We'll post the link to her website as well as the podcast when it becomes available. Got to say goodbye to a couple of luminaries we lost. One was John Warren Giles, better known as Jay Giles, the founder of the Jay Giles Band, who passed away last week at the age of 71. That great 80s pop rock sound that infused so much affection for so many folks, right? We'll play one of those tunes. And also Bruce Longhorn, who is not a household name, but is certainly what we would call one of the most sought-after sidemen of the 60s and 70s, recorded on a slew of albums with a lot of folk artists, including Tom Rush and Joni Mitchell, and Bob Dylan. That was his favorite, Bob Dylan. He was, in fact, the inspiration for the song Tambourine Man. Bruce Longhorn passed away just the other day at the age of 78. So we'll leave you with a pair saluting those two gentlemen, and we salute you. Hey, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Thanks to the TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML at headquarters. Take care. We'll talk soon.
you'll be a